B2, number 12B.
Ezekiel, everything is numbered. You know, everything has measures, everything is numbered. And it's rather tiring to read over chapters and chapters and chapters how everything, every little detail has its place. Now that New Jerusalem has so and so many towers, and each tower is so big, of this length, of that breadth, of this height, and so and so many. Oh, you get nearly. And then, you see, what? He has wheels, and then he has wheels within the wheels. You see, just as we had it, we had the four, and then the four in the four. He gives a wonderful explanation of how we restore understanding in consciousness. He shows the method of how to get understanding. He shows it through the days of creation sense, how we can restore in us understanding. Can you see that this is something different than Isaiah or Jeremiah? In Isaiah, the cry, God said, you are a stiff-necked nation, you don't know, but I'm going to teach you understanding. Then when we come to Jeremiah, he accepts that challenge. Says, all right, I'm going to accept that I must have understanding and that each one must have understanding. But Ezekiel shows how to get that understanding. He gives the pure method in his language, naturally, how to get the understanding, and therefore restores the understanding in men. Is that clear? Then we come to the last column, the science column, the operation of the idea in its principle. Christ, science, really. Beautiful. Says, the Christ wants that every idea operates in its principle. The Christ does not want that the ideas operate for anything else but principle. This is Haggai, or Haggai, whatever we call it, defines that statement in a terrific sense. I wish each one of us would be able to have that Haggai in us. He says, yes, I know, you like science. You like the temple, but you like your own temple. Each one of you is going to use God to build his own house, his own sealed house, as beautiful as possible. He says, each one of you try to use the Christ idea for himself, for his own edification, for his own glory. But he says, but the house of the Lord is laid waste. And you don't build the house of the Lord. And he urges them and says, build the house of the Lord. Go and build it. And he said, you see, I should have said this before, all these are the post-exilic prophets. Think about?
You did say
that. Yeah, post-exilic prophets, where they came back from Babylon and tried to reconstruct the temple. And the first thing they did when they came back, they reconstructed their own houses, their own sealed houses. And the Lord came and said, that's not what I want. I don't want that you use Christian Science for your own sake. You have to use Christian Science for the whole, for the temple of God, for the whole world, for truth itself. And so he urges them to build step by step. You see, again, you have to step by step concept, as we have in the platform here, that they laid stone upon stone, stone upon stone, and the glory of the temple will be greater than the last temple. Actually, the moment we have gone through that experience of the Babylonic captivity, if we have gone enough through deep waters, through hell and high waters, then we will be always a bigger temple than before. And our lives will be quite a bigger life and a more effective life than before. And so he defines the real operation of the idea. Namely, he defines the operation of ideas should always be for its principle, never for yourself, never for a personal concern. Always for the glory of God, for the glory of the temple. And they started building it. Then comes Zechariah, a young prophet, the youngest prophet, they think, there ever was. And he's just a scientist to the bone. As I have said to you before, he gives his short prophecy in the four orders. And in those four orders he shows how we have to operate in our understanding so that it transforms really our consciousness of a false life, in a false temple, into a true temple. So that this transformation takes place within us. That we are no more tempted really to use science for our own sake, but really do it as Haggai has stated it. Then comes Malachi, and he said, but be a jolly good priest in your temple. Be a good priest. Namely, in order to be a good priest, evil has to disappear, good has to appear. You are only a good priest if you come with the whole of good to the Lord. If you put everything you have into this science. And then prove me if I will not pour out the riches of you. He says, you can't get anything out of the Lord if you don't put in as much as you can. If you go to the Lord as a beggar, if you go to the Lord and offer him sacrifices that are not good, that are polluted, then it won't work. You can't fool God. The Christ is an operative power, and therefore Malachi shows this wonderful sense that we have to go to the Lord with the fullness of the seven synonymous terms, and then we get back the fullness of the seven synonymous terms. We can't be beggars in science and say, I don't have much, but you, God Almighty, you are such a big Lord, and such a rich Lord, you give me something from you. You have plenty. Because it's all a matter of inward consciousness, that the more, with a greater richness of consciousness, we approach God, or the true priest in that temple, the more we receive from the Lord. And then comes Daniel, you see, and he really then operates as the Christ sign. We have here sign. He really operates as the Christ sign. He shows like Zechariah, he shows through the four orders the operation of signs in a wonderful way. First in the word way, where he says, where he builds up his understanding. Step by step, where he says, all I need is understanding. And then in the Christ sense, where he can use that Christ mind to analyze every evil. He analyzes the dreams of the various people and tells them what they don't know. He has the mind of Christ, the Christ mind, which can analyze everything. And then through the Christianity order, he shows how with that Christ mind, the whole world will fall to pieces. And everything from all corners of the world, they will come and say, you Daniel, what you have, we want it also. And that all the nations round about will come to him and say, we want your understanding. And then finally says, he shows, that's only a matter of the ever operation of principle of the ancient of days. That is a fact in being, and it always was that way. Can you see the wonderful structure? see of the wonderful structure of this Christ matrix. In this way, you get a warm sense of all what the Christ office is, in its various aspects, various shapes. Yes. Actually, perhaps in a day or two, or next week, we can show you that this is only the beginning of the prophets. And what we can do then with these prophets is to take it out of the biblical language even more and see the ever-present laws of the Christ. Now, do we have some more time?
Yes.
Or is it quite enough? Are you exhausted? Well, just make a short break. So let's have a quickie on the Christianity matrix. As it is the Christianity matrix, actually, those 4 times 4 must convey something very different than the Christ matrix, because they all must have the overall tone of Christianity. And this Christianity has a lot to do, naturally, with that grace of God, which the New Testament has given against the law of the Old Testament. So, those 16 epistles, as you see them here, see, in this matrix of Word, Christ, Christianity, Science, here again, Word, Christ, Christianity, and Science, is now showing the whole sense of true Christianity, no more the sense of the Christ. But Christianity naturally reflects the Word, Christ, Christianity, and Science in its manifold respects. Now, the first vertical column with the 4 epistles of Romans, 1 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians, and James really show the grace of God which has come through the New Testament. It's the grace of God against the Old Testament sense of the law. It's the new gospel, so to say. Therefore, the Word is first stating, so to say, the new against the old. He shows, therefore, that the Christ has revealed itself, that God just pours out full grace to mankind. And so we come to the Christ, which shows that this grace is giving the fullness of glory to men. All these epistles, like Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, and then Peter, is showing the fullness of the Christ glory that comes to men. Then the next column, Christianity, shows man's perfection. Here we have Colossians, 1 Thessalonians, 2 Thessalonians, and then the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, epistle of John. Letters, you call them letters or epistles of John. They all show really the main point of Christianity. Here we have the focal point, namely man's perfection. And then, finally, in the last column, science shows the science of man, that this man's perfection must be understood as a science of man. And there we have the pastoral epistles, Philemon, Hebrew, and Jude. You see, again, on the bottom horizontal line, we have James, Peter, John, and Jude. These are the epistles of the disciples, whereas the others are Paul's epistles. Just as we had in the Christ matrix, first the 12 minor prophets, and then at the bottom line, the major prophets. Here we have the epistles of Jesus' disciples. Now, what does it mean? Oh yes, so on this side we have the word Christ and Christianity again in its operational sense as it appears in the human. See, this is again the sense, the relative sense of Christian Science. Here we have the absolute sense of Christian Science, which shows that Christianity has given a completely new vista, completely new faith, so to say, and has asked us to accept a new faith. That's the word, you see. But then, the word is always that which presents something new. Then we have the Christ, which says that the moment we accept something new, it begins to transform. We have transformation. The Christ is always that which transforms. The moment it begins to transform us in our life, we come to the outcome of that transformation, namely to the victory and to the triumph. We gain a victory and triumph. See? Wonderful. And the moment we gain a victory and a triumph, we come to the last of science, namely, where we see that we have a living proof of our faith. First, up here in the world, stated that there is a new faith, that this new faith transforms us, that through this transformation we gain a victory over the old man, and that this gives us a living proof, a new life, completely new life. Isn't this a logical sequence? All I want to show is not that you know afterwards what I have said, just to impress the logic of it, that it isn't something made up. That it is always recurring and occurring just in different melody, in different tones. Just as if one would listen to Bach, well, he is a great systematizer of music. I don't know anything about music, but I just say what other people say. He was the great systematizer of music. Well, when one hears Bach, you hear always the same melody, but always transformed a little bit, in all shapes, you see, but you sense it is the same thing coming, but always different, shadowing, always with different shapes. So it is with the 4x4, they are always 4x4, it's always the four sides reflecting each other, but we can put that under the main category of the Christ, or we could put them under the main category of Christianity. And each time, naturally, the symphony is a bit different. Now look here what he says. We start with Romans. It's the first one in the Bible. What is the teaching of Romans? I mean, it's saying a lot if one has to reduce the 18 chapters just into one sentence. But that's the scientific analysis, you see. That's the work. Just to state that in one sentence takes about half a year work or so. What he said is that he comes and says, look here, old boys in Rome, there's something new. There's something new. Give up the old, give up the Lord. We have found grace, the grace of God. And he presents, again, the new vista, or the definition of the new, that's the word. And he said, and he shows them, he presents to them, he explains to them, the new that has come. That's come, look here, we have something found, we have found something completely new. It's no more the law, obeying the law. Now, all is grace. It's not your righteousness which counts. Now, it's the righteousness which is before God which counts. That's presenting first the new faith of Christianity. Then comes 1 Corinthians, and you see that grace is going to do something. It's going to transform something. So, 2 Corinthians comes, and he writes to Corinthians. You know, those Corinthians weren't the best people. They were even naughtier than I was. In that you know, in that port gathered all sorts of things, you know, and he has to deal there with all the adulterers and the drunken people and the homosexuals and everything, and he calls them and says, you know, you old boys, since I was with you and have given you Romans, if I've given you the new teaching of which I gave in Rome, of the new faith, you have become quite new people. It has transformed you. You are no more the same. You have won a new style of life. Then he has to write them again a bit later, and they come to 2 Corinthians and says to them, typically, you know, typically Christianity sense here, he says to them, look here, stick to what you know now. Stick to it, stick to it, stick to it. Don't give in. And he said, if you don't give in, you triumph. You will always win. And you get the victory and the triumph. And he says, if you don't believe me, I'm just going to tell you how it happened to me. And then he begins to brag about himself. He said, you know how I was persecuted, how I was stoned, so many times shipwrecked, so many times I was hungry, so many times I was robbed. And he gives them all sorts of things and said, but I have prevailed and I have won the victory. Nothing on earth, he says in 2 Corinthians, will shake you if you persevere in your new faith. Isn't it wonderful? See? All that 2 Corinthians is just full of showing that if we stand to the new teaching, to the new wisdom, the Romans, that it will transform us, but that even if we come into tribulation, says, don't mind it, just stand like a rock, and you will triumph. And shows how he always triumphed in every situation. Then comes James, and rounds up the whole thing. You know, James is that which says, yes, that's all right, what my dear friend Paul was saying, that we live through faith, and that all that is necessary is faith, and that faith releases grace. James comes along and says, but that faith must have proof. It must be a living faith. And he combines faith with deeds. His whole epistle is full of that, that faith should be a living faith, and that only by living that faith we have to give living proof of the new teaching. Yes? Okay. Then we come to the second vertical, to the Christ. To the glory of Christ, I named it, or we could say to the fullness of Christ. All these epistles here that come now, Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, then Peter, they all show something which we need so much, that we don't just stay in the first column of the word with Rome, Corinthians and so on, where we have a new vista and so on, but where we see that the whole fullness of the Christ is coming to us and living in us. Not just a little bit. In Galatians, he first states the new vista of the fullness of Christ and says, you know, that Christ which I have, the new teaching of the Christ, Christianity, which has been preached, is absolutely sufficient in every situation. It's so full that you don't need anything next to the new teaching, next to the new teaching of Jesus. It's completely sufficient. He says, don't rely in certain cases on something else, and again on something else. The Christ is all sufficient for every case. And he just hammers in that we only need really that one and all sufficient Christ. That is the Christ of all. That he states. But the moment he comes to Ephesians, he shows that this fullness of the Christ, if we let it in, that this begins to transform us. That this fullness of Christ frees us from all the littleness and the finiteness, and that the fullness of Christ is living within us. Now the Christ comes and lives within us. And then Philippians comes and shows the victory and the triumph of it, because he shows them again that he says, if you persevere, there is a lot of sense of persevering and persevering, being steadfast, whenever it comes to the Christianity sense here. If you persevere, then really the imperfection is giving place to perfection. And it gives that sense of imperfection, yielding. So that the fullness of Ephesians is going to be manifest in Philippians at the fullness of Christ. Then in 1st and 2nd Peter, he shows that this fullness of the Christ comes here as the fullness of understanding. 1st and 2nd Peter just shows that, namely, that he says, if you have a full sense of life, you get the full victory. That if we live our faith really through hell and high water, so to say, that we will find the living proof of the fullness of Christ. Okay. Then we come to the third vertical to Christianity, where the next epistles, Colossians, 1 Thessalonians, 2 Thessalonians, and 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John show man's perfection. And you see how the steps go. First, here in the word on the top, he shows the grace of God. I have found something new, the grace of God. Then it says in the Christ, but that grace of God is so full that you don't need anything besides it. It's a fullness that comes to you, and it comes in a full measure. When it comes to you as a full measure, naturally the outcome, Christianity is always the outcome of the Christ idea, you have a full sense of man. A full sense of man, namely the perfect sense of manhood. And these here speak about this perfect manhood. Colossians, therefore, says, as a statement of the new vista, says, all these people have shown you up to now that there is a fullness of Christ coming to you, and therefore, when it's in you, therefore accept, Colossians says, therefore accept and acknowledge yourself as perfect men. That point where we have to be son to ourselves and say, I'm no more going to run myself down. Now I begin to accept in me only the perfect man. And so he begins to accept that. 1 Thessalonians then gives the transformation and shows how this acceptance of the perfect sense of man begins to resurrect us step by step, transforms us step by step, gives us a new form of manhood. He always indicates that we should claim the Son of God, to be the Son of God, and that this is that which step by step by step resurrects us. Then you come to 2 Thessalonians, he had to write them again, and said, don't give in. You come now to Christianity and says, don't give in. Remain steadfast in acknowledging that you are perfect men. And in that way you gain triumph or mastery of what he calls the Son of Perdition. Mortal man. Can you see, now you get the victory inward of the mortal man. I think it's interesting to see, you see, we may read Thessalonians, 2 Thessalonians, and we may have read with great pleasure, you see, that man will be victorious over the son of perdition. This point here of Christianity as Christianity always is very tempting, it's always very nice and so on. But what's the use of it to stay just in this, at this point of intersection, and just say, all right, I claim for myself the perfect man, and this is the solution for the son of perdition in me. How on earth can we do that without what has gone before? If that which has gone before is not understood, we will do it in a mental way. We claim for ourselves in a metaphysical way, I'm the perfect man, I'm the perfect man, I don't give in. Then comes all that affirmation and denial and so on, which has nothing at all to do with that whole Christianity sense. Because that victory over the son of perdition is the natural outcome of our consciousness of grace and of the fullness of Christ. Only because we have that wonderful vista of the grace of God, that everything is by grace and not by our own work, that grace is a full grace and comes in its abundancy to us, then we see that will in the third column here in Second Thessalonians just resolve the son of perdition, and we gain victory over him, so that we gain mastery.